Okay, Pat Norton will now deal with disclosure.
Okay, as Bob suggests, the term for producing evidence of one sort or another in arbitration is typically disclosure, although the American term discovery is used so widely that they're almost interchangeable. And the first general point is that it is quite different from U.S. litigation. There are several reasons for this. The international rules of disclosure are shaped by several factors. One is efficiency, that there's an expectation that arbitration will be faster and more efficient than U.S. litigation. It's not always true, but that's certainly the expectation. And that encourages less document or other production. The other feature of arbitration that changes the rules is party autonomy. The parties have a large role in being able to set the rules for themselves, to tailor the arbitration in ways that make sense for them. And thirdly, I think the big issue, one that we've already discussed to some extent, is cultural. The rules for international discovery of this sort are essentially a compromise between civil law procedures or expectations and the common law. Within this general structure of how the whole thing works, there are two principles that basically conflict with each other. For many people and for many years, there has, again, been an expectation of something that's much more efficient and quicker than litigation, domestic litigation. On the other hand, most people these days enter into arbitration because they want a neutral forum. Neither party to a transaction will agree to the other's courts. So the arbitration is to be something in the middle, something that's neutral. But a lot of parties still expect that the process will be more or less the same. That for American lawyers, many of them expect that they will have all of the procedural rights and remedies that are available in federal courts, for example. And so accommodating both of those expectations of full legal process with the expectation that this is going to be more or less quick and dirty dispute resolution is often hard, and it creates a lot of friction. The two basic points I think to keep in mind about discovery and arbitration. One, there's a lot less of it than there is in U.S. Litigation. And secondly, that the arbitrators have a great range of discretion. Under all of these rules, and under most municipal laws to the extent that they govern us, the terms of the arbitrator's authority is very general and quite vague, but is almost always held to accommodate ordering whatever production the arbitrators think is appropriate. One of the results of this general expectation and the general vagueness of the applicable institutional rules are the IBA rules of evidence, which are in here at tab 13, I think.
Yes, 13.
These rules were prepared by a large committee of the International Bar Association. I think it's probably fair to say that they're the most effective set of rules of this sort for international arbitration. They were initially prepared about 20 years ago, and they've been amended once or twice. they have, in effect, become sort of the best practices standard or the default rules for the preparation of evidence in arbitration. They can be made mandatory, usually in the procedural order or something at the beginning of the arbitration. Sometimes, perhaps, in the contract itself. But most often, they're adopted as guidance. That is, the part of the first procedural order will say the parties agree to use as guidance in their presentation of evidence and discovery of documents the IBA rules. So they're not binding, but they're there and can be referred to and relied upon. From the arbitrator's perspective, they have a additional sort of advantage in that if there are seriously disputed issues as to how these things should be conducted, and there's an IBA rule that's more or less on point, it's going to be very hard for the parties to complain if the arbitrators go back to the IBA rules. They provide a sort of legitimacy or a legitimizing structure. Even with the IBA rules and the applicable institutional rules, there are areas that are going to be quite vague and open. And that allows for considerable range of interpretation. This is where the cultural effects come in. The way the rules are applied will vary considerably depending on who the parties, who their counsel, and who the arbitrators are. If you're sitting with two other American arbitrators or British arbitrators perhaps, and counsel for both sides are experienced international arbitrators, the rules may be applied one way. If you're in a case with arbitrators from several different systems, notably civil law systems, or if the parties are from civil law systems, then they could be interpreted and applied quite differently and typically more narrowly. As Bob suggested earlier, the civil law system is generally inquisitorial. The parties don't come in and make demands of each other to produce documents. It's the judge, the civil law judge, who's in charge of the process and who decides what evidence the parties ought to be producing. So, that's all by way of general background. As I suggested earlier today, this is one of the parts of the general process that it's important to get a handle on quite early in the procedure. Arbitrations tend to be run by fairly strict and inflexible standards in terms of time. If you've got two or three experienced international arbitrators, chances are their schedules are fairly full, and it's often very difficult to find times that are convenient for them all to fly to Johannesburg or something. Once you set dates for a hearing, it's very difficult to change those dates without causing real problems for everybody. So you sit down at the outset of the case and you say we're going to have a hearing 1 year from today, and it's very important what the interim scheduling dates are for production of documents and resolution of disputes and whatever, because counsel can start playing with the schedule, delaying production of this or production of that, and it can affect the outcome and the ability of people to present their evidence. General observation on requests for document production. are reflected in the IBA rules. First of all, the requests must be, or are expected to be, much narrower than those permitted in say, U.S. litigation. You're encouraged to specify particular documents, documents you can identify by date and author or whatever, and if not particular documents, to identify categories that are as narrowly formulated as possible. And all of that is with the goal of, on the one hand, producing documents that are at least material to the case, if not relevant. Sometimes documents that are relevant are not authorized. And to having some sense of in this process of proportionality as to what needs to get produced. Who should be producing what? How burdensome is it? And do we really need this? I think sometimes U.S. lawyers come away from this process thinking they didn't get everything they should have gotten in order to achieve some kind of ultimate justice. But generally speaking, the tribunals will try to work out something that makes sense in the context of this particular dispute. And it depends on the case. As Bob suggested, when the claims are fraud, it can't really operate without the other side's documentation. Or I had a case a couple of years ago where Bob was one of the arbitrators that was for alleged malfunctioning of a component part of a large machine. Well, the only party that had data on the performance of the machine was the respondent. And you couldn't really do the arbitration fairly without getting a lot of that information. So it varies from case to case, and people try to work it out circumstantially.
Let me ask your view on this. I just penned down what might be a request under the U.S. rules and then a request formulated under the IBA rules and see whether you...
Am I going to get graded on this?
No.
My response?
I am.
Pass fail.
No, but I probably will be. The U.S. rule, you would say, any and all drafts, notes, emails, correspondence, or analyses or memoranda referring or relating to the contract. All right? In the IBA rules, you might say, any documents exchanged between the parties evidencing the negotiation of what became Article 4.3 of the contract. Would that be consistent with the...
I think that's consistent with the general expectation. Or you might have something that limited it by time.
Right.
Documents exchanged, you know, for the month of March 2017, or any and all documents related to the contract during that period, signed by or copied to Mr. Davidson at the respondent's place of business, or something like that. Yes?
Which rules of electronic discovery apply in this situation, especially with regard to proportionality now?
Well, that's a good question. All of the rules, including the IBA rules, have been, I don't know about all of them, a lot of them, have been specifically amended to take into account e-discovery. And as best I can recall, none of them say anything more than this is permitted at the arbitrator's discretion. And then I think you'll find, do you remember anything that...
This is mea culpa. It should be in the book here, but if you go on the JAMS website, there are things called JAMS Arbitration Discovery Protocols for International Cases. And they're similar, I think, but not identical to the domestic case. But you will find protocols on there, and their e-discovery is specifically dealt with. In other words, what presumptively are people entitled to and what they're not. and it's a very good document. Actually, it sort of tracks the language in the New York State Bar Association protocols of some years ago. But check out that document. If I thought about it earlier, it'd be in the documents in front of you.
And so does that update the proportionality concept now?
Yes, yes. Well, it isn't written with a lot of specificity because arbitrators have really very broad discretion. But it does say, for example, only documents in native format and no documents from servers or third or backup servers are presumptively to be included.
Because obviously the difference is going to be billions of dollars if you've got a very sophisticated one taking proportionality rather than doing term surges, which is going to be, you know, time consuming and not effective.
You know, I don't know what your experience is. Mine is that this stuff comes up, but I have never ordered or seen ordered in an international case the kinds of discovery that you're talking about. Once in a while, you find, okay, you can pick, you know, the compromise is you can pick three search terms and four people, and that's it. Pick them and do your run.
I must have just been lucky then.
I agree. In most cases, I've seen the parties specific, both parties agreed that they didn't want to conduct e-discovery precisely because of the costs that would be involved. And that obviously gets into a lot of questions of tactics and discovery and strategy and everything else. I don't think that the search term approach is unmanageable. I've done a lot of that in other contexts, and it can be expensive. But if you narrow the search terms enough, you can provide some degree of comfort to the parties.
Thanks very much. How does that come up?
Well, again, flexibility is the main issue, and you can tailor this any way you want. I would think that both parties would lean toward the most economical approach. The other issue that comes up and affects all of this, and that comes largely from the UK, is that in arbitration, as in British litigation, the costs of the other party's lawyers or whatever can be assessed against you. In fact, in my experience, the English lawyers are, I don't think it's too much to say, hysterical over the issue of costs. It drives everything. It seems much more important than the merits. But when they're confronting a process, a discovery process, that could be extremely expensive, and they have to sit back and think, gee, not only is it going to cost us $500,000 or whatever, it might cost us $1 million, particularly because their lawyers are worse and they spend more money. But that is a part of the way all of these things operate tactically. Another?
Yes. So, Bob, when you put the two questions, if I got it correctly, the one question in the international setting asked for any documents that were exchanged. Whereas the American or the domestic version was any draft and everything
notes.
And anything,
yeah.
Notes and
non-privileged.
It's like a world of difference, you know.
Well,
seemingly,
I was just, this is not necessarily, you know, in all cases. I just drafted them as an example, but just as a little war story, as I'm sitting having a discussion at some event in Europe, and the speaker was. It was a break, and I'm talking, it was a very well-known, famous Swiss arbitrator, we'll go unnamed or something, but he was talking about discovery and U.S. discovery, which they always sort of tout as being a reason why you should choose European arbitrators and venues, so we were having that debate, and he said, the truth, Oh, you Americans, you're obsessed with the truth. And I'm listening to this again. He says, what is it? Who knows what the truth is? These parties are here for a reason. They want to resolve the dispute and get on business. He says, you cost millions of dollars to search for the truth. And he goes, and he was really very dismissive, and I was like debating with him. And it's been a few years, and the guy's got a point, you know?
Bob is reflecting dystopian America.
I had the same dispute, I suspect, with the same Swiss arbitrator at a meeting in Switzerland. But it really goes back to this earlier issue that I referred to, namely balancing efficiency of coming to some resolution of the dispute against the U.S. system, which does aim at producing as much as possible and getting as close to the truth, if you want to call it that, as possible. And I hate to keep coming back and saying, you know, it's put in the arbitrator's discretion, and he or she can, you know, can try to accommodate the facts of the case. And the other point, which really should be a theme throughout all this, is that on these kinds of issues, you can often throw them back to the parties. Say, look, if you guys want to have e-discovery, you talk to each other for a while and tell us what kind of arrangements you can come to. And then we'll think about it and try to tailor it.
Well, actually, that's interesting. You're saying if the parties agree to
speak
X,
up, Michael,
you would
so they can hear you.
This is Michael, just Patrick, based on what you just said. If the parties agree to something, would you respect that agreement, or would you sort of still look to maybe modify that if it's not as efficient or cost-effective as you might think?
Well, it depends, of course, but the default rule here is if parties agree to it, it's okay. Right. And so one of the points I was going to get to in a minute was things like depositions. Generally speaking, you don't have depositions in international arbitration. But if the parties agree to it, there's no compelling reason not to do it. And generally you let them do it.
Well, you still have the tension I think we face in American domestic arbitration, where you have two big law firms and they agree to a whole lot. And then you look and the agreement is, you know, all this e-discovery, 15 depositions, 10 more of third parties, and the hearing doesn't take place for another 18 months. But they've agreed.
Well, but ultimately the whole thing is consensual. And, you know, what they want to agree to, I think there has to be a presumption in favor of.
If I understand the ICC secretariat's approach to this correctly, if the parties agree to it, basically you put, and they know about that, these deadlines become malleable because they recognize the parties' agreement. At least that's in my experience.
Well, yes. Well,
There's pressure in the rules generally to meet deadlines because the institutions, including the ICC, are widely criticized for not being as efficient as they claim they are. And as you suggest, in most cases that's the result of the parties pushing the deadlines back. But the deadlines are there, and the ICC in the last couple of years has become very aggressive about trying to manage those deadlines. And I think other institutions are pretty much the same, just because they take so much heat. But I think, again, that's something you need to manage. If it does look like it's going to take 18 months, then you need to talk about that with the parties. And that's, you know, it's the kind of thing that I like to have on the table at the preliminary conference hearing. You tell these guys, look, we're not going to be able to agree on a 2 weeks of final hearings that we can sit through at any time where you finish discovery. Today we can agree on 1 year from today. If it's not 1 year from today, well, it might be 6 months or a year or something like that after that.
One of the things in the rules, I can read Article 22.1 of the ICC rules. The arbitral tribunal and the parties shall make every effort to conduct the arbitration in an expeditious and cost-effective manner, having regard to the complexity and value of the dispute. And the ICC now has a rule, which I guess we should have discussed earlier, where you will remember there's a calculator and there's a range of fees based on the amount in controversy. They can go to the lower range or they can go below that if they believe your arbitration has taken, and I believe the presumption is like more than 7 months or 8 months or something. It's ridiculously short.
I forget the ostensible date. I was telling Bernie during the break that I was a victim of one of these deadlines last year. And the other two arbitrators with whom I disagreed on the merits dragged out the award through four or five extensions. It must have been at least 18 months or maybe 2 years before the award came out. And they gave us the dead bottom of the fee range. And it was a lot of work in that case, and I'm quite sure that that cost me tens of thousands of dollars. But they were quite adamant about that. I couldn't very well stand up and say, I followed the rules. So, give me more.
Yeah. Well, the new Secretary General there, Alexei Moray, is kind of on a tear to make this more efficient. And he's now they're docking arbitrators for not working fast enough and getting the award out. So I don't think that the excuse is, well, the parties stipulated to 15 depositions, I don't think is going to move him. And it's even to the point where if the delay is due to the Secretariat, like you put in an award and they don't respond for months, the ICC, at least on paper, says that they will reduce their administrative fee and return it to the parties. So he's really into this. So if you have 15 depositions, all of a sudden, or some or four depositions, whatever it is, you can, you know, there's no law to cite the rule and say, we're supposed to do this in a certain amount of time. So why don't you take one deposition each and then come back and tell me why you need others and who you want to take, et cetera, and then maybe you can negotiate a little bit.
Another issue that comes up fairly often in the discovery procedures, documentary procedures, is privilege. And there's a fair bit of overlap around the world about the kinds of privilege that applies to particular documents, but the contours of those privileges often don't overlap. And the favorite example, I think, is communications between in-house counsel and management. And it's obviously covered by privilege here, but not in quite a number of other countries. So the rule of thumb that is typically applied, and I think it's reflected in the IBA rules, is that you apply the most protective privilege that's potentially applicable. You could alternatively try to work out, as a choice of law matter, which procedural rules of this sort ought to apply, but more often it's a practical result. This issue is being studied fairly intensively at the moment by the Dispute Resolution Committee of the Inter-Pacific Bar Association. I know that because I'm going to their annual meeting in a couple of weeks, and that's one of the things that they've got a program on to discuss privilege issues. So it comes up fairly often. Generally speaking, there are no sanctions for failure to comply with discovery rules. That is, in the sense that the arbitrators could fine the party or the like. The normal sanction is adverse inferences. That is very common. The arbitrators decide if you don't produce something you were ordered to produce in the document, documents aren't there, we will infer that the production would have been contrary to your position. There are a couple of countries where you can actually find people.
Article 31.1 of the JAMS rules.
Yeah, that's right. I noticed that. I was surprised.
Yes. Well, we put that in a enthusiastic wave of courage. We are probably alone in this in the international
I think so.
Arena, but the JAMS International rules say 33.1, the tribunal may order appropriate sanctions for failure of a party to comply with its obligations under any of these rules or with an order of the tribunal. These sanctions may include, but are not limited to, assessment of arbitration fees and arbitrator compensation and expenses, assessment of other costs occasioned by the actionable conduct, including reasonable attorney's fees. That's new. Exclusion of certain evidence, drawing adverse inferences, or in extreme cases, determining an issue or issues submitted by arbitration adversely to the party that has failed to comply. Now, we put that in for two reasons. One is because of what it says. And secondly, I think fairly for, I don't want to say marketing purposes, but we want to at least show the world that if you arbitrate under our rules, you certainly get the additional force of compulsion, which you wouldn't under various European rules. And there have been a lot of criticism about the failure of tribunals to correct injustices that happen at the behest of a party in a non-U.S. proceeding.
The other sanction that other institutions without that kind of rule apply is to award costs for some of the discovery proceedings against the recalcitrant party. And that can have some effect, too. Although, generally speaking, if somebody's got relevant documents that have been specifically identified in an order, they don't produce them. They didn't produce them because they had very strong reasons not to. And the legal costs may not deter them. Another feature of this process that you should be aware of is that it is now very common to use what is referred to as a Redfern schedule. A schedule named after a prominent English arbitrator named Alan Redfern, who's also the author of the leading British textbook on treatise on international arbitration. And basically, it's just a spreadsheet, or a table, if you will, in which the requesting party lists in column one the documents or categories of documents that it wants, and in column two, why they are relevant and material in the case, and in column three, why it's the party itself can't produce the documents, and why it's reasonable to request the other party to produce them. And then column four is the other side's response. If it has no objections, usually it's just say, we'll produce. If it has objections, it will state the reason for the objection. And typically, when available, the objections will mirror those set out in section 9.2 of the IBA rules. And then at the end of the day, the arbitrators have to resolve the dispute. And so effectively column 5 is we decide to order X. It's a bit burdensome, but it's not it seems to work reasonably well, and it's a procedure that a lot of people use. So you might want to keep that in mind. There's very little third-party documentation produced in international arbitration, just because the procedures are limited for that. Many of you may be familiar with Section 7 of the Federal Arbitration Act, which does permit either the tribunal or the parties, effectively, there's some argument about that, to subpoena third parties and have them produce documents. And that certainly is used in some cases. Section 1782 of Title 28 also authorizes U.S. courts to order, in the assistance of foreign courts or tribunals, the production of documents. And that permits a tribunal outside the United States to try to get documents inside the United States that would be relevant to the arbitration. There is a lot of disagreement over exactly how that works, and the issue being whether arbitral tribunals are foreign tribunals under the terms of the statute. And there's a split among various federal circuits over whether that is the case or not. There was a Supreme Court decision a few years back in which the court, it was involving Intel. I think it was Intel and AMD. They had litigation. And the Supreme Court interpreted tribunals quite broadly, arguably covering foreign arbitral tribunals. But that's still not universally agreed. Nevertheless, it's something that might come up. In other jurisdictions, it's very unusual to go after third parties. Some of the civil law jurisdictions of Europe, authorize the tribunals to do so if they wish, but generally speaking, I don't think it's their inclinations. I don't think it's an issue that arises very often.
I've seen it come maybe twice. Certainly now that Rule 45, the federal rules, have been amended and there is nationwide service, if evidence from a third party is needed and the third party is located in the United States, the tribunal can always issue a subpoena, and if the parties are willing to travel as well as the tribunal, that testimony can be obtained. In international practice, it's not done very much. Usually third-party testimony is voluntary, and the witnesses just show up. The Hague Convention on the Taking of Evidence, I've seen attempted to be used twice in an international arbitration. It's extremely cumbersome, however, and the tribunal both times blessed it, said if you want to do it, go ahead and try, but we're not going to adjourn the hearing dates while this process is going on, and in neither case was it pursued to the very end. So possible, but rarely come across.
Okay. I've already noted that there are very few depositions, and then only with the agreement of the parties. Virtually never interrogatories. And occasionally there are site visits that, or other kinds of inspection that might be relevant to a case. And I just mentioned in passing that I was in an arbitration seated in Stockholm, and we conducted a site visit in southern China at a factory, the highlight of which was the claimant, the CEO of the claimant, as we were passing through one of the manufacturing areas, leaping over a barrier, running to the other side of the room, and grabbing a bunch of documents that he said, prove our main argument, something, which in fact they largely did. You don't see too much like that. We've already discussed witnesses and witness statements. As Bob noted, direct testimony is typically reflected in a written affidavit, if you will. That has the great advantage of permitting you as an arbitrator before the hearing to sit down and have all the main testimony in writing, along with all the legal arguments in memorials. So you should have a pretty darn good understanding of what the parties' positions are before the oral hearing starts. It has the huge advantage of permitting you to have a much shorter hearing than you might of a trial. The witness statements are written by counsel. Everybody understands that. If the counsel are halfway competent, they're written in a way that sounds like it's the witness's testimony. I had a case last year in Hong Kong, though, where a British-trained local lawyer had clearly written the testimony because it sounded as though it were written in 18th-century English. the witness verily saith. Something like that. It was almost every paragraph was like that. And it was just, it was kind of a joke. So that was just bad lawyering. Everyone who signs a statement like that does not necessarily appear at the hearing. Parties exchange lists of who will testify before the hearing, and then the main part of the hearing is cross-examination. If a witness who is supposed to testify does not show up to be cross-examined, his or her statement is then typically struck from the record or ignored. Expert testimony is very common in some kinds of cases. The parties approach that the way you would expect. Witness statements are submitted by the experts. Sometimes the experts are directed to cooperate with each other. On occasion, the tribunal will appoint its own expert. That is not terribly uncommon. It's authorized by most rules. Yes?
I have a question on experts. Do you typically have the expert statements exchange at the same time, or does the claimant go first and then the respondent, or it varies?
It can go either way you want. I mean, if one side does go first, or in fact at any time, there's usually an opportunity for a reply to what the experts said.
So the practice is the same as domestically then?
Yeah, basically.
Just come up domestically this week.
And the experts can also be directed to meet and come up with a common agreed statement of facts. I've never seen that done, but it can be done.
Ever?
I'm sorry?
Ever?
I've never seen it.
Yeah.
And then the other process that is quite common is to have witness conferencing for experts. That is, to have each side's expert in the room to be jointly examined both by counsel and by the arbitrators. It's more commonly referred to as hot tubbing, but witness conferencing is the more polite term for the process.
If I could just, I have seen hot tubbing on more than one occasion. And it's been extremely effective because it tempers the tendency towards advocacy that the experts might otherwise engage in when their counterpart is sitting at the same table or in the same room and being asked, well, what do you think about that? What do you think about this? And you can go back and forth because you have the power to proceed in the manner you think is appropriate. And with respect to whether or not there's common ground, I had one proceeding in which I was a lawyer in this one, so it's many years ago, but it was at the Netherlands Arbitration Institute. And the issue was a DCF, a discounted cash flow valuation. And there were two experts on each side, one expert on each side. And they were ordered to get together and just point out the areas of disagreement. And there were two areas of disagreement, which was the terminal value of the investment and the WACC, the weighted average cost of capital. And so the testimony was they were hot tubbed, and they had a testimony on just those two issues because they agreed on everything else. So it is possible to cut through this if you are so minded, and it lends itself to it.
I'll hand it back to you for...
Okay. We're going to move on now to hearing procedures. And they're really, the list will be on page... the part D is in David 6 of the outline, which is in tab 1. And we've already talked about the witnesses, fact and expert, and compelling attendance. Subpoenas are not ordinarily used for no other reason. Often foreign jurisdictions don't operate under the same procedure. if there's a witness under the control of one of the parties and the other party wants that witness to appear, absent some good reason, the other side is expected to show up, even if that witness did not file a witness statement. Although this is really an area of great discretion, you know, the usual when the one side wants the chairman of the board of General Motors to show up for no good reason, you know, you are, of course, entitled to say no, or at least to ask for a showing of why that should take place. Some procedures, and in my experience, the non-U.S. arbitrators are more likely not to compel the attendance of a witness who did not submit a witness statement in support of the claim. The other side can say, make whatever hay they want out of that. They can say, well, they didn't show up with the guy who negotiated the contract, and there's a reason why, and they can advocate in that way. But most tribunals abroad will not compel Mr. Jones to show up if Mr. Jones's lawyer did not see the need for Mr. Jones to file a written witness statement in support of the claim. That's not universally followed. In one case, we did order someone who was supposedly a key witness to make himself available for examination at the hearing, notwithstanding the fact that he did not submit a witness statement. The next thing are written exhibits and a core bundle. I remember there was a question asked about the documents. What do you do with 100 documents or 1,000 or 10,000 that are listed? Most of the time we don't see lists, but each side will submit beforehand, just like they are compelled to do under the domestic rules, a list of the documents that they intend to offer in support of their case and in rebuttal. And the parties will be asked to prepare witness books, usually four sets at least, one for the claimant, one for the respondent, one for you, and one for the witness. There are two other arbitrators. There'll be two other sets. And unless the arbitrators are comfortable with electronic delivery of these things, and most people like the hard paper, I hate to say it, even though there are a few that will be comfortable with flash drives or whatever. Only the documents that are going to be used or that a party may wish to use at the hearing will be bound and in back of you in books. You will also ask, it's getting to be common practice and a good practice, to ask for something called a core bundle. Now, there may be the four or five or six documents that both parties agree are going to be referred to all the time. And the contract, for example, or the license agreement, or the notice of termination, or the smoking gun, or whatever it's supposed to be. And the purpose of that, and you as an arbitrator will make it clear, that the purpose of that is simply to avoid the need to maneuver heavy books every time someone comes up with something. So you'll have a smaller bundle which will copy just the key documents. Then, of course, you have to say the appearance or non-appearance of a document in the core bundle has no bearing on the evidentiary value, and that's to prevent them from throwing everything but the kitchen sink in the core bundle under the theory that it's not going to be considered. Administering oaths, we talked about that. An oath is very important in a non-U.S. context. And you might, in the document that we looked at before, you know, the one, the single page that asks for the, or that recites, which is, I guess, tab 19, that recites the final status conference checklist. This is, I copied this from domestic cases. You might want to add another one, another 16. Will oaths be administered? And if so, by whom? There may be local laws that impact on that. The availability of cross-examination, Pat explained that if someone submits a witness statement, if the other side has a choice, they can say everyone who submits a witness statement must be subject to cross-examination. If the other side wants to waive it and the tribunal agrees that it doesn't need to hear that witness, then the witness statement can be taken as direct testimony.
It's like an admission.
Yeah, right. Or if, of course, the other side insists that anyone or everyone that submitted a witness statement by the other side appear for cross-examination, they must appear for cross-examination, or their witness statement is struck from the record. That was not always the universal practice and might not be in some jurisdictions. Just sort of keep in the back of your mind that cross-examination is a product of the common law system. And therefore, when you get to these civil law systems, cross-examination is not a right. The judge asks the questions the judge wants to ask, and the other side answers them. And that's the way it is. So in some situations, cross-examination is not permitted, or is permitted after a big debate and only narrowly. I remember the one hearing that I sat in as a wing arbitrator in China under the CTAC rules. There was a big discussion about cross-examination, and after a discussion, the chair allowed some, but very limited, and it was not very effective, and it was done really to give the other side what it thought it was entitled to. Pat is smiling because he's done a number of these cases in China, and he obviously knows what the general skill of cross-examiners are there. Also, while I'm on the CTAC, on this case, we had a preliminary conference, and everyone was present in Beijing, but I was on the phone at 10 o'clock at night in my living room. And the chair was very good, spoke English fluently, and he was very concerned that I'd be part of it and explained everything. And he set a schedule, and this was, the call must have been in September. He set a schedule, and he said, well, the hearing date, what are people doing, like October 23rd or something? And I said, well, aren't we going to have any sort of document exchange? And there was this pause on the other end of the phone. I thought I'd lost the connection. And he said, no. No such thing. So there you go.
I've had cases where I'm told, fairly consistent with a lot of Chinese litigation, the documents were produced only at the final hearing. You have no ability to review them beforehand. And they were produced by bringing in boxes of loose documents. Here's one for the arbitrators, here's one for the other side. That was that.
That's interesting. In my case, there was no disclosure, but at the beginning of the hearing, the chair said, all right, produce your documents you're going to use. And it was a table like this, a long conference table, and each side spread out the documents it was going to use, and the other side could walk around the table and look at each document and complain if they wanted to about how it wasn't authentic or something like that. It was quite different than what one would expect. But I'm telling you, that call was in September, and I couldn't make it in October. The hearing was in December. So justice was swift.
I'll give you another quick example of how oddly some of these things can go, one that doesn't involve China. I had an arbitration with a sole arbitrator who was German. It took place in the United States, but a German arbitrator. And he allowed very limited cross-examination. Like a German judge, he largely asked questions of the people. And there was no tape, no recording of this testimony. So he took an hour break and then came back in the room and he read his notes as to what each witness had said. And his English wasn't perfect, among other things. So then there was a 2 or 3 hour argument about whether his notes accurately reflected the testimony of each witness. It was a complete disaster.
Yeah, that's the way they do it in many places, and that stands as the record.
There's no, like, vacature for a lack of due process in these things. This is just the way things are done, I assume, right?
Well, there are one of the reasons to deny recognition and enforcement under Article 5 of the Convention is kind of like due process grounds. Everyone has to have a fair chance to present its case, there is a generalized principle. So if you get one party gets shortchanged, they can, for either that the arbitration agreement was imperfectly or the arbitrators imperfectly executed their mandate or whatever, there is room to argue, and it is if a person, but the arguments that I didn't get enough discovery, or I wasn't allowed to cross-examine this witness, right, or I wanted a two-week hearing and they only gave me, 4 days, are going to fall on deaf ears.
Yeah. In most jurisdictions, it would take a really severe case to meet that standard. But what that kind of issue has sometimes permitted, particularly in developing countries that didn't want to enforce an award against their own nationals, was a pretext for saying that this procedure just wasn't fair, and therefore we don't have to enforce it under the New York Convention. And that has been fairly common in a lot of countries. It's getting better, but not uncommon.
Michael? What's the procedure regarding objections to admissibility of a document?
Generally, your scheduling order will say something like the other side is to notify 3 weeks before the hearing of the list of documents it intends to use on its case in chief and in rebuttal. And then 2 weeks before the hearing, the other side must object if the grounds relating to authenticity or privilege, any other objections are reserved for the hearing. And like in the domestic rules, there's no rules of evidence, so hearsay is not an objection, or honored, and people basically say what they want to say. The only document sometimes I put in that category of if you have a question about authenticity or privilege, if any document you think is protected is sort of in privilege by the settlement, because it was done in settlement, for example. Sometimes you'll get an offer of compromise, which will be thrown into the documents. That's the kind of thing you should take care of in advance. Leave everything else for the hearings, and you'll pretty much let it in unless it's, rank hearsay or something you don't think is.
Sounds like similar to domestic arbitration.
Very similar. Very similar in that way. The next, we've talked about experts and hot tubbing, which is common. You can also vary the order of things if you want. In these technical cases, the one in the machine, for example, that we had, or had one involving a bearing on one of these big wind turbines, you have two specific issues that are separate. So you have four experts. And there's no law against you saying, I want the bearing expert to testify for the claimant, and then the bearing expert for the respondent, and then I want the damages expert for the claimant and the damages expert for the respondent. So you can vary that order if you like. Just orchestrate it to be efficient. And sometimes, for example, on the technical experts, it is good to have them testify topically as opposed to all by claimant and all by respondent, if for no other reason you're saving some money for people. It costs money to have these people sitting around for days. And so, if the first witness testifies and the other guy has to sit there while listening to the rest of the testimony, it could be costly. So bear that in mind, too. You have the power to save money for the parties. With respect to issues of privilege, we've spoken about that, and Pat has given one of the primary differences, which is whether or not discussions with internal counsel are in fact privileged or not. And I'm going to just alert you, there are ethical rules that have been promulgated, the IBA guidelines on party representation in international arbitration. And the next time we do this, this will be part of your materials, but it's not in there now, again, sorry. But it's a kind of guidelines that the IBA has produced as to what the obligations of counsel are. You know, in some jurisdictions, it is, for example, against the ethical rules or the bar rules applicable to, say, an Italian lawyer, for him to produce a document which is unfavorable to his client's case. In our rules, it's unethical not to do that if, in fact, you are obligated or requested, etc., to do it or ordered to do it. This is kind of called the double deontology problem when you're between a rock and a hard place. And what do you do about it? The IBA rules tried again to strike a balance, and I'll just read you. One is that with respect to documents, this is just one of many, but for example, information under information exchange and disclosure, it's page 11 of the IBA printout in paragraphs 14 and 15, that a party representative, that's the lawyer, should explain to the party whom he or she represents the necessity of producing and potential consequences of failing to produce any document that the party or parties have undertaken or have been ordered to produce. So you don't, it's not unethical not to produce it, but you're supposed to advise the party who you're representing. And that a representative should advise the party whom he or she represents and assist such party in taking reasonable steps to ensure that a reasonable search is made for documents that you've been ordered to produce, and all non-privileged responsive documents are produced. So there's no obligation, as there is in the U.S. system, where lawyers are also officers of the court, to make sure these things are done and you're responsible. Your obligation under the IBA compromise is to advise the party that you represent, that what they ought to do, and to help them search or to at least satisfy yourself that the search has been undertaken. We should take the last part for awards.
We discussed awards earlier to some extent. And, Bob called your attention to whatever tab it is, 19 or 20, something like that, that has a model award, ICC award, I think.
21 has a template that really comes from the Chartered Institute kind of form, and tab 22 has sample final awards, one of which is an ICC award.
As Bob noted, the typical format for awards like this tend to be very detailed. And much more so than might be necessary from our standpoint. The reason for this, I think, is really twofold. One is the enforcement issue under the New York Convention. Again, if there's some failure to include very small items, very technical items, it may serve as a pretext for somebody to resist enforcement. Related is that many national laws require specific details like that, more so than U.S. law might. And again, it provides an opportunity or a peg to hang an objection to enforcement. So the institutions tend to be very careful. They don't want to be embarrassed by having awards that are issued under their auspices denied enforcement. Some arbitrators carry this to what I think are ludicrous extremes by taking many of the parties' basic arguments out of their filings and essentially cutting and pasting them. Just, you know, 25 pages of procedural developments, and then you got, well, the claimant claims this, and then they switch to the other document, cut it out, paste it right in there. And likewise, it's 200 pages into the document before you get any analysis. In the ICC case, you've got these additional issues from the terms of reference that you really need to have a formal structure of the issues that were addressed, and you need to be sure that all of these issues were have been adequately decided and why.
Yeah, let me just point you out 22.2, page 13 and 14 of that award. You'll see the issues for decision, which is in the terms of reference earlier, are repeated, and then at the, and then they're answered. Did it a little bit, yeah.
It's also required by several sets of rules, including the ICC, JAMS, and the Singapore International Arbitration Center, that before the tribunal, tribunal's award is final, it has to be submitted to the secretariat of the administering institution. And that's essentially for minor checking, format and comprehensiveness of the issues and that kind of thing.
Well, look at tab 20 as your ICC awards checklist.
Yeah. Right. I have found that that process sometimes useful, particularly on some technical issues, but calculations of certain matters and when interest runs from and stuff like that. I have also found it very annoying on other occasions where some person on the secretariat of the ICC purports to correct my English. It's somebody who's working in a second language, and they're correcting my English. Now, that may be personal vanity, but in a number of cases, they would change the language in ways that change the meaning. And that's kind of idiosyncratic. They're trying to control the process a little bit. On one occasion, I also had an objection come back that we hadn't fully resolved one of the terms of reference issues. And the annoying part on that was that the claimant, or whichever side was making this particular claim, had dropped the issue at least a year earlier. Nevertheless, I was supposed to go back to all the early pleadings and come up with an explanation. So anyway, that's the process is there, and it sometimes it's helpful and sometimes it's not. In a number of cases, you will see final decisions on particular issues, jurisdiction, for example. And that those decisions are final for purposes of the arbitration, but they're partial because they don't resolve the whole case. And they tend to be characterized as final award on jurisdiction or final something or other because the New York Convention refers to the enforcement of final awards. There were a lot of problems for a while with people denying enforcement of a partial award. So they're characterized as being final awards. And then, as I suggested earlier, one of the big issues that is, from my standpoint, a real pain in the neck is dealing with costs in the final award itself. People have different perspectives on these. Sometimes it's easy enough for the tribunal to just say, gee, both sides made nice arguments, and therefore each bears its own costs, and they split it 50-50. It's difficult, as I'm sure you understand, to allocate costs in ways that reflect the strengths of the parties' arguments and explain why. We give the winning party two-thirds of its costs or something. And then the question comes back, well, based on what? You thought they won two-thirds of the best arguments? Or and there are ways of doing it, but it is inevitably a headache. And there's also a fairly strong inclination, I think, by Americans, as much as more so than others, to just say, geez, these guys lost the case, and they've got a big award against them. why make it that much worse? You know, it's kind of an adding insult and additional injury to the basic injury. And I've seen a number of arbitrators resist, particularly Americans, resist doing that because it's also somewhat of an insult to the losing lawyers. Like, you know, they didn't do a good enough job even to get part of the costs in the case, and that kind of thing.
That being said, isn't it kind of the opposite rule when you're working with non-Americans? I mean, the presumption is that loser pays.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a cultural issue, and it definitely weighs in the process as to your attitudes toward these things.
And read the clauses, too, because one, I think, in which the award is redacted, but in there, 2.2, did have a provision that said that we were allowed to award costs only if we found one of the arguments to be unreasonable. Others will say the prevailing party gets its costs, and then you have to decide who the prevailing party is. But the presumption, in my experience in international cases, is that costs abide the event, although rarely 100% worth. And as Pat said, the U.S., if you get a panel of all U.S. arbitrators, it is not unknown at all that each party will have to bear their own. That's indeed what happened in that case. If you read through, that's at 2.2, because we did not find any party's arguments unreasonable, and therefore we split the costs even. I just want to mention two things, and then if you have questions, we can take them. One is on practice hints, which is the last page of the outline. You know, it's frustrating, I know, because we could spend entire days on any one of these things. But let me just point out D and E, which is the use of secretaries or clerks. Very common in international arbitration that the chair will appoint a secretary, sometimes an associate in that chair's law firm or practice, sometimes someone else. The ICC has a policy, fairly new, that says that outlines exactly what a secretary or a clerk can do, which is not to deliberate or decide anything on the case. And very importantly, if you're in the ICC and everyone agrees that you can have a secretary, the secretary's fees come out of the arbitrator's pool. It is not an additional cost to the parties. I do not think that is the JAMS rule, but we do have the rule that says that if you use a secretary or a clerk, there is a process to be followed. That process includes an explicit statement to the parties of what the clerk or the secretary is going to do. The clerk or secretary has to fill out the same disclosure forms as you did, because you don't know, maybe the secretary's husband works for one of the parties or something, you know. So that has to be done. You don't just appoint someone to help you, you know, like a former clerk or something. You have to go through a formal process to do that. The last is performing independent research. You can do that if you want, but if you come across a case, and the ICC requires this, at least in the two awards, the most recent ones, is that you have to say all of the cases that you cite here have been discussed by the parties in their briefs. They're very sensitive to that. You can't pull a case out of the air that the parties have not discussed and make a decision based on it. If you find a case, in one of my cases, there was a court of appeals, there was New York law, and the court of appeals, after the hearings, came out with a case that arguably, impacted upon one of the issues. And so, after consulting with my non-U.S. Counterparts, that a letter came out from me that said, please review the case, and here's the link. and give us your views in no more than 5 pages of whether or not this impacts on any of the things we have to decide. Don't cite a case that has not been discussed by a party, certainly not in an international case, or you are giving fodder for applications to vacate.
Comes out of a fairly common practice in civil law, where the civil law courts follow the old Roman principle of the court knowing the law. Remember that as curia novit juris, or something like that.
Hmm.
It's actually a fairly common procedure, I understand. And it was one thing that common lawyers have fought against.
Yeah, so they're very sensitive about that. The ICC is going to ask you to make that statement in your award certification. Okay, that's what we have to say. We've got 7 minutes if anyone has any questions. Yeah, it's different. Not really the bodies as much as it is the philosophy, I suppose, of the arbitrators. There's one side says, look, you're not there to represent a party. You have to understand, and especially if you've been in practice for a long time, you do understand that the judge is not the smartest guy in the room. The judge, he or she, smartest meaning, not that the metal beanie doesn't, you know, the lever doesn't go high enough. There are a lot of facts that you know and are important to you and your client that never see the light of day in a courtroom or in a hearing room for strictly strategic or tactical reasons. Maybe there's another project which is going on. Maybe they're bidding on another project. Maybe they have an insurance claim against this insurer somewhere else, and they don't want to emphasize an argument that's going to hurt them in the other case. So be very careful of assuming the role of the kind of know-it-all arbitrator who's going to say, well, this is easy. I mean, why don't you just cite this case? Just be careful. There's no law against it, but, you know, a lot of people just won't do it for that reason. Mm-hmm. Others, if it's pretty obvious that something is governs, I mean, you're entitled to say, you know, look, this, you know, you're entitled to say it. I think most arbitrators wouldn't. I think they would probably allow the parties to make their arguments, unless it's so blatant, you know, you'd think you're being, you know, your own integrity is at stake for not citing it or something.
So you could come upon a case, and the point I guess you're making is be very careful about how you handle that. It hasn't been cited to you?
Yeah.
But I would think the simple rule would always want to follow the judges and let the parties try the American judges, let the parties try the case.
Right.
And second corollary to that is the lawyers always know more about the case than the judge does, and the parties always know more about the case than the lawyers do.
Yep. That's well said. That's exactly right. I think the way most arbitrators, whether it be domestic or international, would react to these things.
What organization should we make sure we're a part of?
All right. There are a few events that sort of getting yourself out there is very important. Not just contacting the litigators, you know, who do this work and saying that you're available. And I actually used to be skinny until I started to work at JM's, and then I took everyone out for a drink or lunch to tell them I was doing this.
And, well, you know. I knew you beforehand, don't tell
you. All right, Michael, you are not invited to this. but there are also some organizations. Showing up, showing your face at conferences is quite important. To be sort of, you know, they say it's a club, and unfortunately, it goes back to the bad old days when the very few people did this, and it's although the old guard is retiring or worse, and it's now opening up to many more people, many younger people. Women, minorities, everyone has a good shot nowadays, which is a much better system. But you got to sort of show people that you're out there. Now, there are certain conferences that and organizations which are good to join. One of them, I think, is the IBA, the International Bar Association. Although you got to watch that because every year they have a conference, but it's mostly in like in Shanghai or in Mumbai or in you know Barcelona. So it gets a little expensive to attend those meetings. But if you get on a committee and stuff, it's a good thing to do, I think. The other thing is your local bar committees. The New York City Bar Association, if you're in New York, for example, has a committee on international commercial disputes. That's a committee on international law. International law is more of the, you know, should we bomb North Korea as opposed to, you know, the private commercial stuff.
So it's not a should we bomb them, but do we violate international law if we do?
If we do, that's
not the same question.
Yes, this is from someone who used to work at the State Department on my left. The IBA, your local bar associations are good because the international, your appointing parties who are going to appoint you to cases. Maybe the litigation section of the ABA, for example, even is better than the dispute resolution section. Dispute resolution section is good, all right, but you're talking to competitors or you're talking to people who might appoint you as chair, but you're all after the same kind of, you know, cadre of business. So having, for example, the litigation section, or if you have a lot of experience in IP or intellectual property, for example, if you have a specialty, you've done a lot of work in an area, having a subject matter section would be good. If you join any of these things, try to be active. In other words, the bar associations will have reports that will be written, or there'll be CLE presentations. Get yourself on a panel and just get yourself out there. You know, it's there's no substitute to doing that. And I won't bore you with a war story, but you got to keep on telling it. I mean, I took someone out to lunch, and then 2 years later, she asked me who at JAMS should she appoint as an arbitrator in a commercial dispute. I said, "Well, how about
because she already met you?"
I said, "Well, how about me?" And she said. Oh, I didn't know you did arbitration. You actually acted as an arbitrator as opposed to administration. So you've got to keep on, you know, you keep on doing it. You write articles. JAMS should reprint them for you. I hope they still do that, and you can mail them out to 200 of your closest friends and relatives. And, you know, it's a process, but like anything else, your first case is the hardest. And after you do a good job on your first case, you know, then they'll go, you'll be on the list. You're a contender. And, you know, you've got to be in it to win it, as they say. And I know I'm on a lot of lists and I never get the appointment, but that's okay. Every list I'm on is a great thing, you know. So my name appears somewhere, all right? Okay. I think we're just about finished. Lunch for those in attendance should be out there. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.